I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of rockets and two high school kids from Nyack, New York, who were part of that passion for rocket launching, the chance to ignite a fuse and pierce the atmosphere with a homemade device. Except for Stephen Schwartz and Georg Deutsch, it became much more than Saturday afternoons in the park. As their rockets and the boys' ambition got bigger and bigger, they traveled to New York City. They wheedled their way into the head offices of major corporations like Union Carbide and Bendix, looking for free stuff.
And we would go into these places in suits. We were teenagers. And basically negotiate our way to see a senior executive. And more often than not, they would give us what we asked for
some
free.
Kind of support.
The ingenuity of these two rocket boys took them all the way to NASA. Stephen and Georg will be here after the news to tell me how they did it. We hear a lot these days about a lack of passion for science among American kids. It is true that in competitions that measure math skills and engineering, kids in this country don't do as well as they once did. Today's story takes us back to a time when popular mechanics was popular, and not all the cool kids played sports. Some of them built rockets.
We had maps of all the commercial airlines and where they flew. We checked those. We also had binoculars, and we checked the skies for planes. It was a very clear day. We didn't see anything, and then we launched.
It was almost exactly 50 years ago when Stephen Schwartz and Georg Deutsch began their time as rocket boys. Their backyard tinkering took them all the way to NASA. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Stephen and Georg started out with toy rockets, the ones like those oversized fireworks you can buy in a store, but they soon graduated to making their own serious launch vehicles. They told me about one trip they took down to a military base at Camp Pickett.
We had a 12-foot rocket, which we mounted on top of the car. We were too young, but the car was driven.
Tied on like a canoe?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly,
on a rack. It was a black T-Bird, by the way.
Oh, right, a black Thunderbird.
Thunderbird.
You're driving
really good
on a public highway with a 12-foot rocket tied to the top on I-95.
On the top from New York down to Virginia.
And nobody stopped you?
No one stopped us on the way down. And
well,
they asked us about it
at a couple of toll booths.
Yeah.
Yeah, but those were just the toll booth operators. The police, nobody ever said, pull over, tell me what you're doing, where you're going, what is that?
Well, on the way back, in fact, we were stopped we were in New Jersey on the turnpike by a highway patrolman, as I recall, and he wanted to know what it was, and we said we had launched this rocket in Virginia. We showed him our documentation. He said, fine, because this group back then, this was in the 60s, tried to blow up the Statue of Liberty, and so there was an alert to watch out.
And at this point, you were on your way sort of towards New York because you were driving past New York.
Exactly. But then he let us go. He said, fine.
But hang on a second. This is on your way back.
On the way back.
So the rocket, this 12-foot rocket, you had fired it and recovered all the pieces and put it back on the roof of the car
It came down by parachute. And it had no propellant in it at that time anyway. That rocket, as I recall, had an analog computer we built in it. It had vernier jets to control the guidance, the direction it would go, and a gyroscope. This was quite sophisticated.
And I have to remind you that Georg Deutsch and Stephen Schwartz are recalling a rocket that they made when they were in high school. I asked them to back up a bit. This was the late 50s, the days after the USSR had leapt ahead in the space race with its launch of Sputnik. I asked them to tell me how it was they met each other.
We were in junior high school, and Georg, of course, we called him George then, because if you called yourself Georg, you'd get beat up. Georg came up to me and said, would you like to form a rocket society? And I said, wow, that sounds interesting.
That's kind of how it started. Now, I had been planning one and even had a name for it, a pretty fancy name. It was going to be called the Rocket and Space Research Society. It became a little embarrassing as we grew older.
when George came and suggested this, it sounded very exciting. And given the whole effort of the country to get involved in space, it was very keeping with the times.
How smart were you guys? I mean, were you ready to build a rocket and fire one off, or was this kind of a pipe dream at the time?
Well, you know, it kind of started out small, but, you know, we had grand scheme designs. We had books that, you know, I would ponder over endlessly. But we started kind of simple and working our way up to 12-foot ones.
So tell me about your first one.
Over the course of several years.
Tell me about the first rocket.
The first rocket was more of a toy, shall I say. And, George, you may or may not remember this that well. We took a CO2 cartridge, these metal CO2 cartridges. We emptied out, and we filed the opening to form a nozzle. And we filled it with zinc and sulfur and stuck that into a cigar tube, which we weighted in the front.
You mean one of these metal cigar tubes?
Exactly.
The old aluminum ones.
I remember those. Cigar tubes. And we launched that out of a pipe.
Over the river, into the river.
Well, we went right to Memorial Park in Nyack,
New York.
Which
is on the Hudson River.
On the Hudson River and launched it right into the river.
Did you guys have any idea if this was, A, going to work, and B, how far was it going to go?
Well, we knew it wouldn't cross the river. we knew it was going to
river's about 3 miles there.
Yeah, okay. It's a very wide point near the Tappan Zee Bridge. We knew that it would work because we knew the science of it. We didn't, I think, in that one, judge all the parameters in great detail, but we had an approximate idea of what would happen.
Do you remember that sense of watching this rocket take off across the river?
It was very exciting.
And I actually remember that pretty much in the same vein as one of our first test firings, which was of a bigger rocket engine, but that was done in a well behind my parents' house, upside down. And that was a more of a real engine that we put together.
Were you using this well like some sort of missile silo at Georg?
It was like a test silo. It was the equivalent of a static test firing where the engine was actually pointing down. And if it would go anywhere, it would go down into the ground.
Now, just so I'm clear, you weren't actually firing rockets from your parents from this.
Not up. We were not up.
No,
just down.
Not up. We were firing down. They weren't really firing. It could only go down. The idea was just to test the engine itself. And, of course, the problem with that was that some of our earlier engines generated an incredible amount of smoke.
Did this happen in the backyard as well?
Yes.
Exactly.
I can remember that we were concerned of always the possibility of an explosion. George, we taped at the windows of your house. Do you remember that?
Oh, that's correct. We taped the windows on the side of
the house.
Can you believe my parents put up with this stuff? We taped the windows on the side of the house across from where the static test well was.
And then
after the
test, a huge amount of smoke just
came up. Those early rockets were a little bit inefficient.
More than a pile of burning leaves type smoke. Like, this was a lot of smoke?
A lot of smoke.
Oh, yeah, that was the point, you know. And then you'd worry that the police are going to come.
Or the fire people. But no one did.
Fire people.
No one did.
That was a problem.
Your parents know what you were up to?
Oh, mine did, yeah.
Yeah, yours did. Mine didn't know.
Yeah, mine did, and they were probably surprised. They just had no objections to any of it.
Now, Stephen, you weren't telling your parents because they wouldn't have cared or they weren't interested or you would have been told not to do it? What was going on with you?
Well, my parents wouldn't have cared. I was much closer to my grandparents, and I told them, and they knew. And I think my grandmother said, Stevie, just don't blow yourself up.
Well, did you get close? I mean, there must have been a point early on when you're playing around with different kinds of fuels or mixing things where you guys got yourself in a little bit of trouble.
We never did. We were very, very cautious. We computed everything. I don't think we ever even had an explosion.
It's amazing. I guess those two things alone, the fact that my parents did not object and that we actually seem to have a pretty good safety record over the years is probably unusual.
I'm assuming, though, that the cigar tube rocket just whetted your appetite for bigger rockets and greater heights. What came next?
Well, after the cigar tube rocket, we created our first series was called the Gamma. And the Gamma rocket was about a foot and a half long. It used zinc and sulfur, the same propellant, but it was we did it as a solid fuel. We basically melted it down into a solid propellant grain, it would be called. And we had a parachute system on it. And we launched that rocket for the first time at Camp Pickett, Virginia, now called Fort Pickett in Blackstone, Virginia.
How big would this rocket have been, Steve?
Well, the rocket was about a foot and a half, I think. And it went up about, what did it go up, George, about a mile?
We had a 20,000-foot ceiling there, but that one probably only went up about 6,000 feet.
What do you mean
like
you had a 20,000-foot ceiling? You weren't allowed to shoot a rocket?
We were allowed only to we had to actually document the fact that this was supported by the Army base there. I guess it was part of the government project to support amateur engineers and budding scientists, et cetera. But they allowed us to fire rockets at this artillery range at what was called
tank firing range, I think it was.
Hang on a second here. So two 14-year-old kids show up with a foot-and-a-half-long rocket and say, can we blast this off?
We would fill out forms for the Army ahead of time, months ahead of time, and they would
for
have
permission
to, approve
to do
it,
this.
For permission. They would get
and
the permission
do calculations.
Based on, yeah.
It just seems today so unbelievable that kids, because you were kids.
We were kids.
Would be a part of something like this, Go into your basement and play with video games. Stay away from the stuff. It's dangerous. You know what I mean, Georg?
When I think back about it now, I think about how it would be virtually impossible, given the tenor of the times, to get your hands on it's not impossible to get your hands on the chemicals, but I guess it would be very, very much a problem these days to be, working with what are essentially explosives in a constructive manner.
And where were you storing these explosives? In the lawnmower shed?
They weren't really explosives, uncombined.
They were in George's parents' basement.
It's in my basement.
That's right.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Soon enough, Stephen Schwartz and Georg Deutsch needed more sophisticated tools to make their rockets go further. So they used a little entrepreneurial creativity. They took out an ad in one of the mechanical magazines, as the Rocket and Space Research Society, and significant national corporations actually welcomed the two of them.
When we went to New York City, we would write major companies like Union Carbide and Fisher Scientific and Frazee Metal and Bendix. And we would go into these places in suits. We were teenagers. And basically negotiate our way to see a senior executive. And more often than not, they would give us what we asked for
some
free.
Kind of support.
Is that
support.
What you were looking for, Georg? You were looking for bits and parts and tools and
Well, we were looking for support. And for example, Steve was actually very good at this. but I knew what I wanted mechanically. For example, Frazee Metals became a very good sponsor. They gave us very nice stainless steel and other high tensile strength products for building our rocket chambers and our solid fuel rockets.
Yeah, Fisher Scientific gave us our chemicals. Union Carbide gave us special high-tech chemicals.
Let me just figure out how this happened. Now, you would contact them by phone, by mail from NIAC and say, I'd like to come down and talk to you about this.
We'd send a letter on our letterhead, which we made up in shop in junior high school. And, we would show up, whether we were invited or not.
No, but some executive at Union Carbide would open the door and see a couple of kids sitting there.
They would. They would humor us, but once we laid out our plans, they would be impressed.
It became a whole lot easier, by the way, after we got the letters that Wernher von Braun sent out to about five companies.
You see, in the early 60s, Wernher von Braun was to rockets what Bill Gates is to computers. He was Mr. Rocket. To have him on your side was its own kind of launch for these two rocket boys, and I'll get them to tell me how that happened in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. In the years after the Sputnik launch, outer space was cool. Science was sexy. And Stephen Schwartz and Georg Deutsch built rockets. But even as high school kids, they weren't happy with the backyard scale of rocketry. They studied the latest technology, experimented with computers, and of course they had their heroes, like the famous rocket scientist Wernher von Braun, a man who was closely watched in the news.
Dr. von Braun, how would you say we stand in relation to the Russians, and do you think we can ever catch up?
I'm convinced that in the space field, the Russians are ahead of us, particularly in large weightlifting capability, and that at the moment the problem is not so much to catch up but first build up the working speed that they have already demonstrated. And only the future will tell whether we'll manage to close that gap.
Von Braun was one of 100 or more German scientists who'd come to the U.S. after the war. Stephen and Georg recall that these men were the minds behind many of the breakthroughs then in rocket science.
And eventually, a bunch of them were concentrated in Huntsville, Alabama, at the Redstone Arsenal and then what was becoming the George C. Marshall Space Flight Center, which was really beefed up after the successful Sputnik launch by the Russians. But we visited there in the mid-60s.
I think it was July 65, George.
1965, yeah. Of course, the Space Flight Center was in full operation at that point there. They had successfully developed the Saturn I rocket, and they were working on the Saturn V, which was going to do the moon landing.
It was a great time. Von Braun invited us down, and we spent 2 days there. We had, as our guide, Dr. Fritz Pohle, one of the great scientists. We spent time with Dr. Ernst Stullinger, who was the deputy director of the center. Unfortunately, Von Braun was out of town that day, but he...
We had very good meetings with Stullinger and Neubert, who were also among the top scientists.
Summer of 1965, though, you guys would have been how old at that time?
15. And
this doesn't surprise you that these top rocket scientists are going to make time for the next generation to sort of come back down and say, you know, welcome, we'll show you around. It's just
amazing.
It is amazing.
It is actually, in retrospect, the more I think about it, it's amazing. I don't know, it seemed all fairly natural then, but I guess it was somewhat of a different time, and there was this feeling of really encouraging and, you know, building up the young people in this country who were interested in,
it was the early days
missile programs in space and so on.
I have a question for you guys. If you're a high school rocket genius and the local paper is writing about your exploits, is it easy to get girls?
It was by the time I hit 12th grade. It wasn't so easy earlier on.
And unfortunately, one of the universities that was sponsoring our rocket society, NYU Engineering School, asked me to go there without finishing high school, so I didn't stick around.
You missed the senior prom.
I missed the senior prom. What happened was the high school said, okay, we'll treat you as if you're a senior. I did go to the senior prom.
As a junior.
And I had a lovely girl. My girlfriend then was remember Marcy Schilsinger, George?
Yes, I remember Marcy.
Yes. Yeah, well, Marcy Schilsinger, she
Marcy
later...
Marcy was a pretty sexy girl. Yeah,
pretty sexy.
Yeah.
She later became a porn star.
See, you know, so the geeks today just don't have it, right?
You guys are at
the top of the heap.
Top of the
mid-60s.
Well, yeah.
As I listen to Stephen Schwartz and Georg Deutsch talk about everything they did with rockets, I'm thinking to myself, what else could they possibly have wanted to accomplish?
We had always thought we were going to be doing this very minimal amateur satellite project, you know, some very minimal project of being able to put an absolutely miniature satellite into orbit.
You were serious about this? You were
mm-hmm.
actually planning to launch a satellite. It wasn't just a how high can we go, how big a rocket
right.
can we build.
It was on our business cards.
But it did say, amateur, can you remember what it said?
Amateur satellite project. On it, you know, it's one of those, you know, and when were those business cards printed?
I printed them up in junior high school shop, George.
So
63, 62.
63, we were imagining it.
Yeah. And
when we first got together.
But it also depends what you mean by a satellite. A satellite can be anything that goes around that orbits. And in our case, we were not envisioning anything large. In fact, the satellite that we eventually did launched and which hopefully, you know,
made a couple of orbits,
was the size of a BB. So it was very
small.
But
it still had to go from the surface of the Earth, though, to get into orbit?
60 miles.
Well, we launched, the rocket was up to them, but then we ignited through a shaped charge and it went a little bit higher.
60 miles is a little bit beyond what most high school rocket makers actually aspire to.
That's true. But you see, the reason that we were able to do this is because the rocket power was actually not used to achieve orbital velocity. The rocket was just used to get to that height.
Right.
Normally what you also have to do is then the rocket has to go into, you know, has to be going at 18,000 miles per hour as it's, you know, approaching an orbit above the Earth's surface. So whether it's 60 miles or 100 miles, usually they're 100 miles. We started out kind of low. But instead of using the rocket power to get to that velocity, we use this technology that was, it's called shape charge technology.
It's one of the things that sets off nuclear bombs, for example.
So tell me about the day.
Well, it was a beautiful day along the Hudson River, I guess. We did our our satellite orbit, comes back to where we did our first cigar tube launch in the Hudson River, although not from a public park, but from a very unpopulated area called Grassy Point, New York.
This was a little bit anticlimactic, actually, because actually this whole rocket was much, much smaller than rockets that we had launched up until then. And also, we actually didn't bother to get any kind of official permission.
We couldn't get permission, George. No one would give us the permission.
There was just no permission.
So did you have to sort of set up the launch site in secret or do it at a time when nobody knew where you were? What was...
It wasn't in secret. We actually invited the editor-in-chief of a local newspaper to come and record the whole thing. And we had a series of news articles in the paper. So it was something...
Yeah, but nobody was broadcasting the location and the time of the launch.
Not at the time. This was all after the fact.
No, right.
We knew that we were doing something without authorization. We knew that if you launch over 500 feet, you violate federal airspace. We had maps of all the commercial airlines and where they flew. We checked those. We also had binoculars, and we checked the skies for planes. It was a very clear day. We didn't see anything, and then we launched. now the problem was the transmitter was tracked from our member who was then at Rutgers, and so it was tracked up to about 60 miles. And then the shape charge went off, and the transmitter was supposedly injected into orbit. We could not pick up any signals. Now, whether the shape charge destroyed the transmitter to the satellite or whether there was some glitch in the transmission, we're not sure. And, in fact, there's a possibility several days later that there were weak signals.
Right.
Robert Jones, who was tracking, thought that he had a signal at least once.
Okay, but let me test this with you two as scientists. Civilian satellite launch, success or failure?
Unclear. I'd say...
I'm hearing a waffle from scientists.
I'd say perhaps.
We've always said perhaps. Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
So you go back to high school after you successfully or not launch this first civilian satellite. And are you talking about it in the hallways? Is there a buzz in the school? I mean, is this just, I mean, I gather you're not carried on people's shoulders at a pep rally, but I mean, this is kind of a big deal.
Well, actually, the most we remember from that period was the fact that the FAA got on us.
And you mean the feds came to your high school?
Absolutely. Yeah. See, because they read about it in the papers.
Uh-oh.
Federal marshals came, took us out of class.
Yeah. No kidding.
To the principal's office.
Yeah, we had meetings in the principal's office about this. And the thing I remember most about it, maybe Steve remembers some other things, was the fact that they kept insisting on who is the adult who's in charge and responsible for this. And I remember looking at them directly in the face and says, "You're looking at them. At us. There's nobody else." And that's what they were very frustrated about.
They didn't believe you.
Well, I don't know if they
eventually
did. No, they did. They did believe us, but they were frustrated by it because they were actually looking for an adult to
charge, someone to charge.
To charge, I guess.
Did they threaten the two of you with anything? Did they say?
They said they would arrest us unless the article had been in the paper for several, I guess, a day or two, and had been picked up by UPI and Associated Press. And they said that unless we were to call and retract the story, that they would press charges.
What do you mean, retract? Say it
well,
didn't happen?
Well, I guess say it didn't happen. Yeah, I'm trying to recall
I don't
details.
Remember that part, Steve. That's the part that
they
I
wanted
remember.
You to lie and say it wasn't us or it didn't happen or...
They did not want to have a lot of national publicity. There was already regional publicity.
They wanted this to go away.
They wanted this to go away. They didn't want to have to deal with us with other people who might violate federal airspace. and set a precedent in not prosecuting us. And they didn't. I don't think they really wanted to prosecute us either. I suspect if we had played hardball, they would have just gone away as they did.
But what happened in the long run?
We called a lawyer. We didn't know any lawyers.
Well, did your folks get involved? Did they come down
to
school?
No, they didn't. Mine didn't know about it.
No.
We
kept them out of it, and we preferred to keep them out of it.
Yeah, we called the father of one of our classmates and spoke to him, and he said to do what they say and don't get the charges against you, and that's what we did. We probably should have played hardball, but, you know.
How old were you at the time, though? What, 16?
We were 16 or 17.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Stephen Schwartz and Georg Deutsch went on to college, but neither went on to careers in rocket science. Steve studied engineering and went on to become a lawyer. Georg studied physics and methods of space propulsion, but he wound up disillusioned with the slow pace of government-supported science.
I actually dropped out for a number of years and was a drummer in a rock band. Actually, it was called St. Elmo's Fire. It did pretty well in New York, upstate New York, which is where I was. It was a pretty good
band. An appropriate name for your band.
Right. But, and, you know, I worked on English sports cars and ended up somehow in brain research. Currently professor of radiology and neurology studying brain scan imaging methods and applying them to the study of normal aging and diseases. So it's been a long way. I've still been always completely intrigued by space travel and rockets. I love rockets and the idea of space travel. I'm a little disappointed in, I guess, how far things have gotten in the course of my lifetime. I would have expected that we would have been farther along at this point.
And I think that also you don't have the public support the way it was when we were kids.
Not the public enthusiasm.
No, the enthusiasm is lacking. And after the shuttle explosions, you know, I think there's a lot of concern, a lot of mixed feelings about space flight, and some questions as to why we should be allocating our money towards that when there are so many more immediate issues to deal with down on the ground on Earth.
What about the two of you, though? Have you stayed in touch over the years since your...
I would say we're still best friends since age 12.
A few years where we were kind of out of touch, probably those years when I was doing my rock drumming and working on sports cars.
There was no email then. What can you say?
No email.
Right, but we definitely stay in touch these days. It's amazing how frequently the birthdays are coming up.
In fact, it was one of those birthdays, Stephen's 50th birthday, when Georg plotted something of a surprise, a chance to have some fun with his teenage rocket science pal.
I was to come there as a Russian scientist who knew about Steve and his rocket friends' exploits from the 60s. This was actually done as a surprise to Steve as well. So I came there all dressed up in a three-piece suit, doing a very good Russian accent, which I can do because I do speak Russian. And
how did you introduce yourself? Do you remember?
I introduced myself as Professor Georgi. I forgot. I don't even remember the last name I used. Professor Georgi, Ivanovich or something like that. Georgi Ivanovich from the Russian School of Aeronautical Technology. And I was there to discuss ex-secret documents that the Russians had when they had been following the exploits of the Rocket Society, because they were very interested in these ideas of efficient launchings of small satellites.
Now, Steve, you knew nothing about this, right?
Should I lie? Susan leaked it out.
You weren't supposed to know anything
about this. I wasn't
supposed
to know, but I sort of knew.
Give me an example, Georg, of the spiel that you went through, the accusations that you made.
Well, what I did is I did a poster presentation to this group. I was showing pictures from newspaper clippings that the Russians supposedly had with secret stamps.
Pictures of the two of you as teenagers holding rocket parts,
right? From newspaper, exactly. These were supposedly from the Russian archives. So we were following these young men with very keen interest in the ideas of this miniature satellite design. Maybe I'll get better Russian as I get along here. It's kind of hard for me to do this.
You had him totally convinced.
I was told by some of the people that I had, they were convinced when I gave the presentation until the point where I told them that, well, we were able to recover some of the items that these young men had launched, and we kept it in secret location and under secret files until recently when they were declassified. And here are some examples of what we found. And I showed them some nose cones and showed this little miniature life support system for a little mouse inside of nose cone. And we were very impressed with that. And then I started opening this thing that I had brought with me, which was a rocket nose cone. And then I pulled out a little miniature mouse.
Rubber mouse. Rubber mouse. Imitation mouse.
And then some people started saying, wait a minute.
Rocket Boys are Stephen Schwartz and Georg Deutsch. I actually discovered these two through an innovative form of citizen journalism that we're a part of. It's called the Public Insight Network, and it's a place where you can bring your expertise and your stories and your old charred rocket bits to the radio. You can read all about the Public Insight Network on our website at thestory.org and choose to become a part of it there if you so wish. And if you are there, you can also see pictures of Stephen and Georg from their rocket days.
Fly me to the moon and let me sing among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me.
And maybe you have a childhood passion that wound up affecting your later choice of a career or other life's directions, and you can leave me a note at our website. It's thestory.org. Now, in just a moment, another story of childhood curiosity. How it was that the grandchildren of the great boxer Muhammad Ali began asking questions about his Parkinson's disease and how that brought the family a little closer together. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The last time the great fighter Muhammad Ali stepped into the ring, it was a fight against Trevor Burbick. Drama in the Bahama. No one really expected Ali to win. He was 39 years old. Burbick was 27. But still, the champ talked it up as he always did.
I'm making all you old men feel proud next day, and I'll prove Burbick will be no contest.
As it turned out, though, Ali was overmatched. He lost the fight in a unanimous decision.
Well, I'm just sorry I lost. But I did my best, and my body wanted to do things that it couldn't do. My mind said do it, but I couldn't do it. And I don't think it would be too wise for me to keep boxing.
This next story introduces us to one of Muhammad Ali's children and how it was that the end of the fighter's career gave her the chance to know her father a little bit better. Rashida Ali was there in Nassau at the Burbick fight. She went into the dressing room with her dad after his loss.
We were laying down together and we were talking, and he was tired and there was a lot of celebrities around and in the entourage, and it was pretty intense. I was happy it was over. I knew at that point that this was his last fight. So we were ecstatic, the family, and we were quite pleased that it was over because it was painful for us to watch.
Tell me a little bit about the moments that you do remember, because I bet that large chunks of your childhood, he just wasn't around.
Well, of course not. I mean, in the heyday of his career, in 2, 3, 4, or 5 years old, he was not there. This was the bulk of his career where he was the busiest,
yeah.
And he was training and traveling, so we did not see a lot of him, unfortunately. But, you know, I remember you know, flying to Nassau, Bahamas, and getting really excited about this event and seeing him after the fight. And every time we got a chance to see him, it was a big deal. It was like Christmas. I mean, a special occasion.
Did you ever get him to yourself?
Never. I think at a young age that we knew early on that we had to share him with the world, and very, very rare occasions that we got a chance to spend time with him alone. And that's unfortunate, but, and there's so many of us too, so I'm kind of fighting for his attention because it's so many of us. And outside of all the kids, it's a lot of the hanger-ons and the entourage, and, you know, it's just a big mess when you get to a point where you're so famous, where everyone wants a piece of you.
Yeah, yeah. No, I can just imagine that being tough on you as a little girl, because everybody wanted to be close to him. He had this huge light of charisma around him, and everybody needed or wanted to be close, you know?
Yes, of course. And he had a great personality, and he loved the attention. So he really loved being around people as much as people loved being around him.
Do you have any one memory of a time when it was just the two of you together?
I have more alone time with him now as an adult, but as a child, no. I don't really remember any time where it was just us. It was always all of my brothers and sisters and him. Of course, he'd take us out to eat, and it would be all of my brothers and sisters and him. And, you know, it's a lot of us, so it's, you know, it's trying to get our dad's attention, and so we didn't have much of those alone times. But as we got older, I've gotten to spend some more quality time, which is, I like these times a lot better.
Rashida, you would have been a teenager when he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. Did that help explain some of his quirks at the time?
Well, I was in junior high, I believe, and no, it didn't explain anything. The first symptoms, the slurred speech and the shuffle walk and all, I just thought Dad was getting older. Of course, he was only 42 when he was diagnosed,
so that
wasn't the reason.
Yeah.
But, you know, to a 10, 11, 12-year-old, you know, 40's old.
Yeah.
So I just thought Dad's getting older, and, you know, these are some of the symptoms of age.
And when did you start to make the turn to taking an interest in the disease itself and then understanding how that was affecting your father?
Well, I grew up with my dad with Parkinson's. All of my memories is with Dad with Parkinson's. So Parkinson's for me is normal.
Yeah.
I don't remember him in his Cassius Clay days. Of course, I wasn't born then. But of course, when he converted to Islam and he became Muhammad Ali, and I don't remember that person. Of course, I see it on film all the time, but I don't remember that brash talking Louisville lip guy. But I do remember the man, the gentleman, the humanitarian who was struck with Parkinson's disease. I didn't ask any questions. It was quite normal for me and my family. It was just kind of the way it is. Of course, I didn't even ask questions until later on, fast forward, after I had my own two children. They see their grandfather all the time, and they start asking questions that really I never asked, because it was kind of like understood.
Yeah.
But I think children are a lot smarter than we give them credit for. And so they want to know what's going on, and I couldn't explain it.
What did they ask? What were their questions?
Well, Nico was 4 and a half at the time, and we were all working out at my dad's gym. You know, we were kind of just playing around, and Nico kind of walked over to me and kind of whispered, "Why is Poppy shaking?" And, you know, I said, "Well, he has Parkinson's disease." I looked at him like, what a silly question. And he kind of looked at me like, okay, speak English. And I kind of felt like I was shafting him in some way, because I wasn't explaining why Poppy was shaking. And so I think at that point it was a pivotal point in my life where I started to really try to understand for my kids, because I never asked questions about Parkinson's disease. Of course, I was motivated at that point to be able to study Parkinson's and what it means to have Parkinson's, so I can explain it better to Nico.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Rashida Ali is one of Muhammad Ali's 9 children. The boxer has had 4 wives, and as Rashida was explaining earlier, there's always been something of a competition among the kids for his attention. Rashida now lives in Vegas. Her dad lives in Phoenix. And it was her own research into Parkinson's that brought her closer to her father, and still gives her own kids a chance to spend time with their grandfather, Muhammad Ali.
They see their grandfather a lot, and I think that's important that they interact, that relationship is important. And I talk to them about tremors a lot, and when they see their grandfather, they help him. They hold his hand. They walk with him to, you know, the kitchen or outside where they go out and play football. And so they really are, you know, taking a proactive role in helping their grandfather. And I think it's really a good thing because I witnessed this and I'm thinking, well, I really did a wonderful job as a teacher and a parent.
Talk to me a little bit, Rashida, about how your own relationship with your father has changed since you made it, you know, kind of a personal thing to understand Parkinson's and to explain it to other people. Have you become closer to your dad?
Absolutely. I think we're always trying to, it's funny because all of the kids are trying to get daddy's attention. You know, when there's a red carpet event, you know, me and my twin sister fight over, you know, which side we're going to take. But I think girls do that with their dads. I think, you know, we love him so much and we just want to be with him all the time, unfortunately, because, you know, we grew up not seeing him a lot. So we are dying to see him a lot. But I think because we want his attention and we want to stand out in his mind, I've almost indirectly taken on a proactive role as a Parkinson's disease advocate. And I think by that career choice, I think it has led me closer to my father, because if he could speak like I am talking with you right now, I think he would do the same thing. He would travel all over the world trying to help increase awareness and funds for Parkinson's organizations all over the world and also teach.
One of the things you zero in on your kid's book on Parkinson's is having the grandpa draw pictures for the kids.
Yes.
Does your dad
yes.
draw pictures for his grandchildren?
He does. I think it comes quite natural. My dad's always been a great artist, and I think it's because he gets it from his dad, my grandfather, Papa Cassius, who was a professional painter in Louisville, Kentucky. And he was a professional painter. He's an artist.
Yeah.
And I think that's where my dad got his ability to draw. And, you know, if you look at earlier drawings of my dad in the 60s, he had, you know, of course they were stick figures, but they were interesting drawings all the same. But I think he, now with Parkinson's, has become even more artistic. And his ability to draw has become more pronounced. And I think that worked better in our favor because it really helps that the children are able to communicate with their grandfather without having to ask over and over, what did you just say, repeat. And that's really, it's really more annoying for us than it is my dad, I think, really. We don't want to keep asking him to repeat himself. And so one day I saw the boys get out paper, and my dad already has markers. He has a ton of them. And they started drawing for each other. And they started exchanging their drawings. And I witnessed this, and it was incredible because I started to realize what a great nonverbal way to communicate with your loved ones with Parkinson's disease without really having to speak much.
People will be listening to you talk about this on the radio and wondering what it is that Muhammad Ali will draw for his grandchildren. Describe one. Describe a picture that's a favorite of yours.
Well, there's one picture in particular that he started off with a blank sheet of paper and two little stick figures in the middle of the paper, and then he started to draw a box. And we're thinking, okay, what is this? And then he started to draw a quote box, and then one quote has Ali and one quote says Frazier. And then he starts to draw like little dots all around, and you start to realize obviously that it's a boxing ring.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible to watch him draw because he really gets into it. He puts colors in it, and it's just incredible. And once he starts a drawing, he doesn't want to finish it. It's just incredible how he just really has this really incredible eye. And we always keep markers because it keeps him busy. My dad gets bored, so we keep Sharpies in our purse. And he just starts drawing on the tablecloth of any restaurant we go to. And, of course, the manager's not going to say a word because everyone's trying to fight for that picture when he's done. In fact, I fight for it. I'm like, Dad, I'm going to have that picture before you finish, just so you know I got it. But all the pictures that he draws for my boys are keepsakes. They're heirlooms. And they're certainly very important items for me. So I frame them all and put them in my office and put them in the boys' room because, you know, it just means a lot to us to be able to have a piece of my dad's artwork up in our house. And I just think it makes my boys feel great because they were a part of that experience.
Yeah. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. We have a copy of that one drawing that Muhammad Ali made, the one of his fight with Joe Frazier called Rumble in the Jungle. It's posted on our website at thestory.org. Rashida Ali is one of the fighter's daughters, and she's written a book that she calls A Child's Guide to Parkinson's Disease. She says that Ali, these days, has some days that are better than others, but she says he's never self-pitying.
My dad never says, why me? Why me? And that's why we never say, why him? Because he feels that everything happens for a reason. Even him being stricken with Parkinson's, he believes that every single thing that happens in life, good can come out of it. And so, honestly, I've never heard him complain once.
Does he close down sometimes, the masked face or the blank stare?
Yeah, it's very difficult to smile sometimes when my boys try to tell my dad jokes and he, you know, obviously it's funny, but, you know, the masked face comes, you know, and my kids know all about that too, so they know they're being funny.
They don't take it personally.
Oh, of course not. Absolutely not. Because they understand. They understand that masked face is very typical with people who have Parkinson's disease.
Does your dad still work out?
He's still in the gym all the time. He's incredible.
What's a workout for him in the gym? What does he do?
He's amazing. I mean, you know, he does the bike and he does the shuttle bag and he boxes. And he does all the, you know, workout as a boxer, but he does a lot of, like, you know, cardio, the biking and stuff like that.
The shuttle bag takes a lot of coordination, a lot of timing. He's still got that, huh?
Of course. His body is, like, incredible. It's the same as he was as a boxer. I mean, those muscles bulge out when he's exercising and when he's weight training, obviously. And I'm like, wow, Daddy, you look awesome. And I think one of the gifts that he has, because he's always taking care of his body as a boxer, I think it makes it easier for him to do a strenuous workout because he has a natural ability to push his body to the limit. He's not huffing and puffing like I see other people.
What are the times when you feel closest to him, Rashida?
When I get a chance to go visit him in Phoenix and no one else is around, boy, do I take advantage. I talk to him about my life. I talk to him about, God, I mean, advice he could give me, you know, in my own personal life, in my own career. And God, you know, I gained so much knowledge from him because who better to ask than someone who's been around the world 3-4 times already and has gone through what he's gone through. So I really do ask him about life lessons and advice he could possibly give me. I take the quotes that I write them down because I need them sometimes, like when I'm having a difficult time or going through some pitfalls. I use his words of wisdom, and they get me through a lot of things.
I mean, his actions, his sort of physical accomplishments, I think, have been an inspiration for so many. But what would be one of these lessons that he's given you, one that you've written down, one that you might carry around in your purse?
So. Oh, there are a lot. Well, I've struggled into acting for a long time. Ever since college, I've been wanting to act.
Yeah.
And it's tough. And I told my dad, look, I want to act and this is what I want to do. And I'm taking all these lessons and I'm taking these workshops and classes and going on auditions and I'm getting a lot of rejection. And he said, man, you picked a tough field. And I said, yes, I did. But I said, so was boxing. And then he said, believe in yourself. That's all he had to say.
Huh.
Just those three words. And it just all comes clear. And then I would take those words in the back of my mind into that audition, and I would just nail it. And I would call him and say, Daddy, I did really good, you know. But it seems very simple, doesn't it? But it means a lot, and it really says a lot about who he is as a person and who he was as a boxer. Because if he didn't take his own advice, then how could he have won so many boxers? How could he have been such a great boxer if he did not take those words and apply them himself?
It's funny, you know, Rashida, because his fans know him as the greatest, but the greatest in a pair of boxing trunks and the gloves and the dance and in the ring. But it sounds like you got, or you're getting a different version of the greatest. Like he's still giving that to you. Is that fair?
I call him the greatest because of his mental strength. And it's very difficult for him when I look at biographies and what have you, and I show my kids biographies and why people make a big deal out of my dad, because he's really done incredible things for not just us as Americans, but for the whole world, and teaching us life lessons about standing up for what you believe in. And he definitely walked into career suicide when he, of course, converted to this very controversial religion and changed his name and didn't go to the war and all these things. It's career suicide. And I don't think most people would have taken that chance. And I think because my dad believed in something and he stood for something, I think that's what makes him great.
Well, and I hear some of it in you. I thank you for being with us on the program.
Well, thanks for having me and sharing my story with you.
Rashida Ali is the author of a book called I'll Hold Your Hand So You Won't Fall, A Child's Guide to Parkinson's Disease. She's one of the daughters of the great fighter Muhammad Ali. You can find links and more information about Parkinson's and about Rashida and Ali on our website. You should know that an increasing number of our stories here are stories that do come from you. Sure, we get our suggestions of topics and guests, but often it's people who are proposing their own stories, things that have happened to them or things that they've accomplished. Why don't you use the boxer's advice and believe in yourself, believe in your story. You can get in touch with me through our website. That's the fastest, easiest way to get something to me. The website is thestory.org, and you can find buttons there to push that'll get you a note to me. You can also leave me a message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862, 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.